Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Chicano movement in San Antonio reflect civil rights efforts taking place in the rest of the country in the late 60s and beyond? And what internal differences in the community had to be ironed out in order for Mexican Americans to present a strong and unified front in demanding social and economic justice? David Montejano grew up in San Antonio and witnessed the dawn of the movement firsthand there, as well as in San Marcos and Austin when he went to college. Montejano went on to become professor of ethnic studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He is author of the new book Quijote's Soldiers, A Local History of the Chicano Movement, 1966 to 1981. He's in town to deliver the Center for Mexican American Studies Distinguished Lecture this evening at UT Arlington. David, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
You write about the fact that you grew up in San Antonio in the 1960s, and at the time, the neighborhood you were from spoke volumes to everybody in the city about who you might be expected to be.
Well, the neighborhood I grew up in was a working-class neighborhood surrounded by poor neighborhoods on three sides. And then across this broad avenue called Culebra was the beginning of the Anglo-North side. And that was like two blocks away from my house. So from growing up in this neighborhood, I could see basically the diversity, you know, that surrounded me. And that avenue, Culebra, which, by the way, in Spanish or in English means a snake, you know, was, a fitting name for the ethnic race relations at the time. You know, San Antonio was very segregated. When I grew up in a very segregated city. And in part, the inspiration for this book had to do with me witnessing the breakdown of that segregation through the civil rights movement. In an earlier work, Anglos and Mexicans in the Making of Texas, I addressed that the division represented by Culebra Avenue. You know, I wanted to talk about that racial division. Now in this work, I'm casting my gaze back at the barrios that surrounded my neighborhood. So in that sense, I'm still trying to understand the world I grew up in.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what you were taught about Texas history when you were in school?
Well, yes, a very different take on the Alamo, for example.
Yeah.
and as a professor of history at UT Austin, I also remember teaching Texas history and the high schoolers coming in believing that Santa Ana had actually invaded the United States. I mean, not understanding that the Alamo was fought on Mexican territory. So, yes, no, I remember the way I was taught Texas history.
Now, your parents sent you to Catholic school where your instruction included what really were the seeds of what would later be called liberation theology. Can you talk a little bit about how you were influenced by your teachers and also by your classmates?
That's interesting that you bring that up because, as I point out in the book, there were really parallel school systems. One was, of course, the public school system, and I grew up in the Edgewood School District, which was one of the poorest in the state, and set the basis for the lawsuit, the Robin Hood lawsuit that I think is still discussed in Texas. I didn't go to the public school system. I went through the Catholic school system. And that was primarily because it provided a good secular education. My parents weren't so much interested in the religious aspect. It was the fact that it provided a solid education. But what you pick up in Catholic school, and especially in high school, as I recall, is this, the teachings about brotherhood, that we're all, we're all one people under Christ and so forth. And I think that humanism, religious humanism, clearly influenced me. I mean, it spilled over. At the time I graduated in 1966, a long time ago, high school. At the time that the civil rights movement, the African-American civil rights movement, was in full swing. And so you come in with these ideas about brotherhood and so forth, and then encounter, when you leave finally your sanctuary, your high school sanctuary, you discover a different world. And that's that conflict between your ideals and the reality is, in a sense, something that led me to begin to wonder about the world I grew up in. It led me into sociology and history.
So talk about your experience. You'd come from San Antonio where, as you describe it in the book, it almost felt natural, which is not to say it was a good thing, but the segregation that you grew up with felt like something that was just there. And you got to San Marcos for your freshman year in college and witnessed something you hadn't seen so blatantly before.
San Marcos was a trip. I don't know how else to put it. Again, you have to think this is the mid-60s, and San Marcos at the time was still considered what we called a cowboy college. But I had felt I had stepped back in time. I mean, I felt when leaving from San Antonio, going to San Marcos only 50 miles away, I felt I had gone back 10, 15 years in time. I mean, if I think San Antonio was segregated, well, then San Marcos was like hyper-segregated. And what I witnessed there, and I was introduced to, segregation. I mean, basically, I remember my roommate from West Texas, an Anglo, would invite me. Oh, we considered ourselves friends. And he would invite me to the theater. And then we'd go down there, walk there together. And then he would sit somewhere else. He wouldn't sit next to me. And I didn't know why, you know. And these are the kind of things that I learned. The incident that I think you're referring to is has to do with an altercation that I witnessed that was very shocking, actually, because this is at nighttime. I'm walking towards a gas station, and I witness this carload of basically drunk undergrads, and they were mistreating the attendant, who was Mexican American. And they essentially threatened to teach him a lesson, okay? And so this is sort of like, I'm thinking, this is the South. I mean, mm-hmm. this is yeah. what I'm witnessing here. And before I could, I didn't know what I was going to do. I was just by myself. But in any case, out of the blue, from the dark, come essentially these, what I call vato locos, crazy guys. These are street youth. Usually considered gang youth by authorities, walking out of the dark, you know, taking off their belts, also cussing or cursing, returning the curses that they were hearing. And it was a racial incident, the first real blatant racial incident that I had witnessed in my life. Fortunately, the deputy arrived and separated the groups. The cowboys leave. And before they're leaving, they shout, "Remember the Alamo!" So anyway, but again, that those kind of incidents are what made me wonder, well, what kind of world did I grow up in? And I want to understand why, you know.
Well, I want to talk a little bit more about the Vatos Locos, because you write that even in San Antonio, where violent gang activity started to sort of drop off in the late 60s and early 70s, police there tended to assume if they saw, I'm guessing, a Mexican-American young man under about 25, their assumption would be that there was an association with violent crime.
Clearly an association with gangs, mm-hmm. And especially the teenagers. And it would just take two or three to for the authorities to consider them a gang. Now, you have to remember that high school dropout rate at that time, well, still today, is very high for Mexican-Americans. At that time, it was over 50%. And so what are these youth doing? You know, if you're not in school, what are you doing? Well, you're hanging out, maybe, you know. They were usually considered to be a gang by the authorities. And as you might imagine, that provoked considerable conflict. You know, among the gangs. There's an entire literature on gangs, and in a sense, one of the things that I try to do in this book is point out how that these gangs end up becoming politicized mm-hmm. by the Chicano movement, and that politicization ends up ending barrio warfare, what I call barrio warfare or violence among the gangs. And why is that? Because the two major concepts of the Chicano movement were carnalismo, which means brotherhood, mm-hmm. and then raza unida, which means united people. And so these are concepts that are now, in a sense, being taught to the youth through deliberate efforts, through deliberate experiments. The activists set up a freedom school, for example, And by the way, that, of course, points to the borrowing from the black civil rights movement at the time. A freedom school is set up for these vato locos, for these youth. You know?
The idea is that if they're drifting, they might attach themselves to something positive that is strong.
At this freedom school, this is where the barrio youth would mingle with college activists, learn about politics, learn about history, philosophy. This freedom school had a theater group. They had a band and so forth. So this freedom school is where many of these street youth picked up certainly the notions of brotherhood and united people, and that we're all in this together. You know, very important that Freedom School was an important institution for the few years that it lasted. Now, I have to mention, and of course, I spend considerable time in that first part of my book talking about the conflict within the Mexican-American community. Mm-hmm. And that conflict initially, as I point out, was, of course, consisted of this gang violence, barrio warfare, and so forth. But what's interesting is that as these street youth become political, that creates another conflict now between the middle class, Mexican-American, who are concerned about these angry youth. Mm-hmm. They're very concerned. And in particular, we have Congressman Henry B. Gonzalez, who I portray as basically the representative of that middle class. Congressman Gonzalez, who's very concerned and makes it his... makes one of his goals the closing of this freedom school that I'm talking about.
His idea was that he wanted everyone to be like him, part of this middle class, and he was very opposed to any sort of ethnic politics, which is ironic given that he was seen as, at the time, a representative of, at least by the outside world, of the Mexican-American community.
I know. Isn't it so ironic? I mean, there are so many ironies. Congressman Gonzalez was a very complex individual and considered to be, of course, a liberal congressman. He was liberal. But when it came to the Chicano movement, he basically tripped out or freaked out. I mean, and there have been many theories proposed to explain that, to try to explain why Congressman Gonzalez reacted that way in a negative way to the Chicano movement. One theory that I appreciate is that his family was an exiled wealthy family from Mexico. They left because of the Mexican Revolution, and that memory carried over. I mean, Henry B. Gonzalez grew up with the bitterness that the family experienced in terms of having lost all that wealth that they had. They came from a mining town where Henry Gonzalez's father, grandfather, great-grandfather had all been mayors. And so Henry Gonzalez himself was expected to rule, mm-hmm. right? He grew up with that kind of background. And so one explanation is that when he saw these Chicano youth using these Mexican revolutionary symbols, I mean, you know, Emiliano Zapata became our hero, and you see all these references to the Mexican Revolution, he tripped out. The other part of that has to do, he saw this as a combination of Mexican revolutionary extremism. And, of course, what's happening in Cuba, you know, he accused many of the activists as Castroites and as communists, you know. So, yeah, that's one explanation for Henry B.'s reaction to the Chicano movement.
We'll get more of the story in a minute from David Montejano. He is professor of ethnic studies at UC Berkeley and author of the new book, Quijotes Soldiers, A Local History of the Chicano Movement, 1966 to 1981. He's in town to deliver the Center for Mexican American Studies Distinguished Lecture this evening at UT Arlington. If you'd like to join the conversation, tell us a story, ask a question, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Montejano. He is professor of ethnic studies at the University of California at Berkeley and author of the new book, Quijote's Soldiers, A Local History of the Chicano Movement, 1966 to 1981. He's in town to deliver the Center for Mexican American Studies Distinguished Lecture that takes place this evening at UT Arlington. It's at 7:30. You can find more information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join us this afternoon, call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. David, tell us about the Brown Berets and the role they played in San Antonio.
Well, the Brown Berets were vato locos, crazy guys. These were the street youth that I was referring to earlier. Many of them were ex-gang members or were gang members. And these, the Brown Berets found their, actually were formed at this freedom school that I had mentioned earlier, the freedom school that Congressman Gonzalez was so adamant about closing. The Brown Berets were taken by this notion of brotherhood and united people and felt that, if this is what we should be doing, we shouldn't be fighting one another. You know, we should end gang warfare. They had two goals, actually. Let's end gang warfare, and then let's deal with police brutality. Those were the two concerns that youth had at the time. Fighting one another, with hostile gangs, and then fighting with the hostile police. And so those were their two aims immediately when they formed this, is we're going to end gang warfare, and we're going to deal with police brutality. They were successful in the first. They actually... because of the networks that they had, they were actually able to calm violence in the barrios for a number of years, and that's one of my main arguments in the book: how essentially the movement, the ideas of the civil rights movement, actually percolate down to the street youth. Then they took on the police brutality issue, and in that they were not as successful. But nonetheless, when they took on the police brutality issue, that's when they gained the attention of the media. Mm-hmm. When they were doing their gang warfare work, everybody praised them and so forth. But when they started protesting and showing up at city council chambers to talk about police brutality, that, again, you can imagine raised considerable concern on the part of the authorities, on the part of Henry B. Gonzalez, and so forth.
Talk about 1970, when there had been a protest in Los Angeles that turned violent, and the mayor of San Antonio, McAllister, was interviewed on national television and asked to speak about whether or not there was similar activity in San Antonio.
There was, in Los Angeles, there was this famous, now infamous or famous moratorium march that ended in violence, and journalist Ruben Salazar was killed, Los Angeles Times reporter. There was considerable violence, and it so happened that Mayor McAllister was being interviewed on the Huntley Brinkley show, and he was asked about the situation in San Antonio in relationship to what had happened to L.A. just a few days before. And he starts talking about how his Mexicans, our Mexicans, are
happy. And that's the term he used, our Mexicans.
Our Mexicans, yes, our Mexicans. Basically, our Mexicans are happy and content here. And they would never do anything like that, and he said a number of other paternalistic things that basically riled the quite a few folks there in San Antonio, who felt insulted on national TV by the mayor. Now, you have to understand, there had already been considerable there was no loss of love here. There was already a track record here of people opposing Mayor McAllister. But in any case, this was sort of like the straw that broke the camel's back, sort of. An immediate protest begins at the Mayor's Savings and Loans Association. And now this is organized by women. This is a very important issue, because one of the points that I make in the book has to do with the rise of women in leadership positions. Okay, I'm talking about Mexican-American women now being spokespeople, now being leaders and actually candidates for office and so forth. This signals a change in gender relations.
Yeah, they said we don't want to just serve you drinks and then walk out of the room and do something on our own. We have every bit as much right as you do to be part of this.
That's correct. Just the movement inspired not just these street youth, but also inspired, of course, the women who take the ideals of the movement to heart and say, well, you're talking about, you're pressing for respect and equality. What about respect and equality between us, husband?
Yeah.
So in any case, but what happens with this boycott is that the women organized the boycott. They took over the boycott, and the boycott, the picket line and the boycott, folks were asking customers to withdraw their savings from the McAllister's bank. And then there was an altercation, where a security guard and some of the picketers sort of got involved in a little tussle. And several, about 29 picketers were arrested, you know, for as a result. Not the security guard, but the picketers, 29 of them. What's interesting about this is that Henry B. Gonzalez has the police records of all 29.
Like in his files.
In his files, complete with police photos and everything, and his handwritten notes. But that incident was important in terms of because then the Mexican-American, the women who organized that boycott were then turned around and pressed their male counterparts for inclusion in decision-making, you know. And in particular, there was a oppositional city council slate called the Committee for Barrio Betterment that the women now insisted to be part of. So two of the four candidates were women. They were the first Mexican-American women to run for city council office.
And that included Rosy Castro, right?
That included Rosy Castro, the mother of the current mayor of San Antonio. So you can see the legacy of the movement in current San Antonio politics.
And his twin brother, the state rep, is that
right? That's correct.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phones first to Thomas in Dallas. Hey, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if you gave any thought or had any remembrances of Doug Somm and the Sir Douglas Quintet. You know, he played with almost an entirely Mexican or whatever Latino band. You know, Augie Myers, Freddie Fender, did that do anything to, you know, to bridge that or whatever?
Well, thanks for your call.
I love Doug Somm and Augie Myers. They're great, and of course Flaco Jimenez and the so-called seven, right? Unfortunately, no, I don't talk about that in the book. I don't really spend much time talking about music or culture. It's just little tidbits. But that's another book. That's a research project I'll hand off to a graduate student.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Gerardo in Allen. Hey, Gerardo, how are you? Are you with us? Gerardo? Okay,
I had it on mute.
Oh, okay, good. I'm glad you're here.
Yeah, I'm a little younger than the professor. I grew up in El Paso.
Shout out to El Paso, so did I.
At the time when the civil rights was going on, I was 19 years old. In 70, I was 10 years old. And so one of the things I remember is my mom being very worried about sending me off to the high school, local high school, because a lot of the neighbor kids who were at that high school were coming home with their windows bashed in, and there was riots happening. And I don't know if you're familiar with El Paso. I know you are, Chris, because you're from there. I grew up in the Bel Area. And so one of the things I remember is that, and then my parents were in the union at the Fada Manufacturing when they went on strike. So I remember not only the union, but also a lot of conversations about the Raza Unida Party. And I don't know if that happened before or after that period, but I remember for a while there, the Raza Unida Party had I guess, some contenders, and they were stirring things up. Did this happen after or after those the period that you're writing about, or no, at the same time?
No, it's at I talk about the Raza Unida Party. This is the period that you're referring to. When you were 10 years old, the Raza Unida Party is being formed, and they're running a statewide slate. They're running a candidate for governor, for a lieutenant governor, and so forth. But that's happening right there in the early 70s.
You know, what Gerardo brings up about his parents, you know, sort of having these solid blue-collar jobs and worrying about sort of these other influences coming in is an interesting tension that I think a lot of people probably experienced at the time. They liked what was being fought for, but they also didn't want to risk what they had already won.
You're right. And that's the tension that I talk about. On the one hand, we had... in San Antonio, about 20%, I would say, the Mexican-American community could be considered middle class. And then you have a working class. But in any case, you had a number of individuals who were either comfortable or concerned if we went a different path, because there was a politics of gradualism, I call it, the politics of gradualism. And things are gradually getting better. You know, we now have one representative on the city council, and it doesn't make any difference if it's selected by secret committee of the Anglo businessmen, but we got one representative. And so you had a number of folks that were very concerned about the angry nationalist tone that one heard from these Chicano youth. You know, they're talking about the downfall of gringo supremacy. You know, this is the kind of language that was being tossed around. And of course, it made a number of individuals very anxious, you know, and worried. I talk about that in the book. Definitely, it was a tension that the entire community felt.
You've talked about city representation here in Dallas. We moved to single member districts relatively recently, but a lot of people feel like that was a very positive change. What changed in San Antonio when the same thing happened?
Very important point to make about the change in San Antonio before the movement. And this is why I claim that the Chicano movement can claim a victory in San Antonio, because before 1966, we had at-large electoral system, and the only viable organization that could actually sponsor citywide slate was the Good Government League. The Good Government League was the political arm of the business elite, the Anglo business elite. And they had a secret committee that would pick the slate. They would pick the token representative from the Mexican-American community and African-American community. And not necessarily were these individuals that were selected residents of either the barrio or ghetto. I mean, and anyway, that was the case before. Then you have the Voting Rights Act that's implemented and breaks up San Antonio into single-member districts. That was critical, because now that made the candidacy of someone of working-class background possible. It meant essentially someone who had extensive family networks and friendship networks could actually potentially run for office. In terms of representation, the change was dramatic. The first city council elected under the Voting Rights Act was a majority-minority council. You had 5 Mexican-Americans and 1 African-American and 4 Anglo-Americans. That was a phenomenal change. It also then set the basis for the election of Henry Cisneros a few years later. Henry Cisneros was a councilman during the time that the Good Government League is sort of going through its death throes. By the way, I should point out that Henry Cisneros, this is an interesting fact that not too many know, ran the first time he ran for city council, he ran under the GGL auspices, and he lost the Mexican-American vote. That's the GGL was so disliked by Mexican-Americans that anyone who ran under their aegis, under their sponsorship, was bound to lose the Mexican-American vote. And that's the case for Henry Cisneros the first time he ran.
The assumption was that he was, is the term vendido?
Yes, sellout, yes. Mm-hmm.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go next on the line to Celso in McKinney. Hi, Celso.
Yes. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am. Go right ahead, please.
Well, you know, I've got to get a copy of this book because I lived through it myself. I'm from San Antonio and went to St. Mary's University, which at that time was the hotbed
yes.
of political activity. And So much so that when the students walked out in Crystal City as a result of the controversy regarding the cheerleaders, we put a caravan together and drove down there and were teaching these kids. Again, keep in mind, we're college students ourselves, and we're teaching these kids math and English and you know, trying to help them keep their studies up while they're walked out. And we're meeting in parks. We're meeting in, you know, a variety of different non-academic places, if you will. And it was an experience. The entire time, you know, from I graduated high school in 1969, and to have lived through that, and then to have lived through that in San Antonio, I got to write a book myself.
I think you'll like the books also. I talk about that whole experience. I do talk about St. Mary's University. You're right. It was a hotbed of activism. As a matter of fact, a young professor, Charles Cottrell, who I quote, talks about San Antonio as being an internal colony. Now, the reason I mentioned Charles Cottrell is because, as you know, he's now, he's going to retire as president of St. Mary's University. So, it's interesting to see where the activists are today. You know, Charles Cottrell, president of St. Mary's, Rosie Castro, mother of the current mayor. And, of course, then you have Charles Gonzalez, the son of Henry B. Gonzalez, all still involved in politics.
A different sort of man from his father?
I believe so, yes. I believe so. Of course, the context is different, too.
Yeah.
Very different.
My guest this hour is David Montejano. He is professor of ethnic studies at UC Berkeley and author of the new book, Quixote Soldiers, A Local History of the Chicano Movement, 1966 to 1981. He's in town to deliver the Center for Mexican American Studies Distinguished Lecture this evening at UT Arlington. Find information about that 7:30 talk on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we do have a line open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Berkeley Professor of Ethnic Studies David Montejano. His new book is called Quixote Soldiers, A Local History of the Chicano Movement, 1966 to 1981. Join us by emailing think@kera.org or calling 1-800-933-5372. David, talk for a minute about this term Chicano, because it was not always something that was employed with pride.
No, you're right. Actually, the term Chicano and Chicana was a lower class term. I mean, it was used as a put down, actually. But if you look at it was used in the 30s and 40s. It probably is a derivation of the word Mexicano from Mexican, Mexicano, Mexicano, and you just cut off the me, Chicano. But in any case, it's taken up by the civil rights movement, by the Chicano movement, to refer to a distinct identity, to say we're not Mexican and we're not Anglo either. You know, we're different. We're a combination of both cultures, and so that was a sense of pride. It was invested invested with new meaning here. You take a lower class term and now you're investing it with giving it some value. It's sort of very similar to the black is beautiful kind of phrase, you know. Now Chicano is beautiful. Being Chicano and Chicana is beautiful.
Let's go to an email now. We have one from Tony in Haltom City who asks, if you have studied or have any experiences with the modern backlash for past injustices that spur the Chicano movement. I've heard Anglos call it reverse prejudice.
Well, Henry B. Gonzalez called it that too. I mean, that's the tension within the Mexican-American community as well. Henry B. Gonzalez thought that the Chicano movement was a reverse racist movement. And actually, he thought that any ethnic organizing, I mean, Henry B. Gonzalez had this vision, this very absolute colorblind vision, which, as you might imagine, really, in a sense, put him out of step with the current situation at that time. But I do talk about that. Yes, no, that's the basis of Henry B. Gonzalez's opposition to the Chicano movement. It's reverse racism. And but the problem with Henry B. Gonzalez was not only did he, in a sense, was he antagonistic to the Chicano movement, but he himself refused to provide any kind of leadership. I mean, that's the problem here. That's the paradox. I mean, he does not believe in ethnic organizing, and but he himself, I mean, in other words, was not going to fill the void at all, and which was very well, unfortunate, because he was one of the few Hispanics in Congress at the time.
You, we spoke briefly about Henry Cisneros, and you characterize him more as a beneficiary of the Chicano movement than as a participant. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh yes, well, and Cisneros himself has acknowledged this. Cisneros was not really part of the Chicano movement. I mean, maybe he was an observer or whatever. Yeah, he was close to Henry B. Gonzalez. He was close to the GGL, the Good Government League that I've been talking about. So he definitely did not come from a Chicano movement background. But what ends up benefiting Cisneros is the organizational efforts, the organizational capacity, I call it, that resulted as a result of the Chicano movement. And in particular, I'm talking about Southwest Voter Registration that was organized by Willie Velasquez, and the communities organized for public service organized by Ernie Cortez. And these two organizations now, I call them second-generation organizations. The reason I do that is because they were not using this nationalist language of the Chicano movement. As a matter of fact, they distanced themselves from that type of the charge of racism. They weren't going to do that. But they were still committed to empowering marginalized communities. And both organizations end up engaging in these massive voter registration efforts in San Antonio. These were their first trials, in a sense. They organize the barrios in the west and south sides of town, and they end up providing the base for Henry Cisneros' victory when he finally runs for mayor. Now, the other thing I want to add is that as a result of that that victory, these organizations then take their organizing strategies throughout the state, throughout Texas, and actually the whole Southwest, and Southwest Voter and Interfaith Network end up essentially moving to California.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Fred in Fort Worth. Hey, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I really appreciate Mr. Montejano coming out and talking about San Antonio. I, too, am from the south side of San Antonio and remember living through this. And I now operate a bilingual Spanish newspaper in Fort Worth. And what I've noticed is the climate is just so much different from what we grew up in down there, not just in the segregation part of it, but as far as being separate but equal. Would you like to touch on that, on how San Antonio and the Mexicano-Americans then were able to assimilate into the process as well as they did, and yet it doesn't seem to have spread as far north as maybe the Metroplex? And there seems to be a line maybe around Austin and San Marcos that kind of divides this sort of willingness to go out and fight the battle.
David, what do you think?
I think that's an excellent comment. Yes, no, San Antonio has changed. I mean, you can see it now. I mean, it's no longer unusual to have a Mexican-American mayor. I mean, it was a big deal when Henry Cisneros was elected, and primarily because Cisneros was the first mayor of Mexican descent since Juan Seguin in the 1840s. So, I mean, we're talking about 150 years, basically. But now it's not a big deal. I mean, it's not a big deal. You know, Julian Castro is mayor, and okay, nobody does a second look here. And so that's true in generally of San Antonio. You have the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, for example, very well established. It's no longer necessary to do protest when you can use the legal system. We now have MALDEF who can actually do the fighting for us. Okay, so we don't have to be in the streets. We can be in the courtroom now. Now, as far as when it's going to get to the Metroplex, well, I think, we'll just have to wait and see.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to David in Dallas. Hey, David.
Hello, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Ma'am, I have a question for Mr. David.
Okay.
My name again is David Buchanan. I'm from the West Side. I graduated from Lanier High School. I'm a graduate of Our Lady of Lake University. My question to him was, what does he see history-wise in teaching young Hispanic Americans the history of our struggle? Myself, growing up in San Antonio, I was only exposed to the American history of our country.
No, that's an important question, and that's why, that's what drives my work, frankly. Okay, this is why I'm writing books. I mean, it's not just to understand the world I grew up in, but also to, in a sense, spread the word. Let others know, look, this is what happened. This is what, I mean, if I had these questions, I figure others had these questions. And sure enough, that's been the case. So, yes, I talk about Lanier. I talk about the West Side. Now we have books, okay? Now we have books that we can actually use in classrooms. When I was an undergraduate, we didn't have any of these texts. We didn't have any history, okay? So in a sense, that's been my mission, I guess you can say, you know, to recover the history that we don't have.
Do you see a difference over the years in what your undergrads know coming in about their own history?
Oh, yes, most definitely. It's changed quite a bit. And there's a vast literature now. I mean, while I wouldn't say it's very vast, but extensive, but I mean, we do have a literature. If I can just be self-serving for a second here, the book won an award, just as an illustration. The National Association of Chicano Studies has awarded me a book. I'm very, very honored by that. But the point I want to make is that there were 17 books in the competition. 17 books. Published within the last year. I mean, that was not conceivable even just 10, 15 years ago. So I'm very excited about the fact that we now do have a history, okay? We do now have a history. When I started doing this work when I was in graduate school in the late 70s, I had to establish the fact that there had been segregation of Mexican Americans. I know it sounds somewhat incredible that I had to do that, but there were folks that were denying that Mexicans or Mexican Americans had ever been mistreated or had ever experienced racism in any. Oh yes, there would be recognition of individual isolated events. They would always say individual isolated events, but they wouldn't talk about a systematic segregation. And so, in a sense, that's part of the recovery of history, okay? And now if you read my work, I think I'm fairly even-handed. It's not to generate anger or anything like that, but it's important to know what happened, why it happened, and then how it became undone. And in a sense, that's what Quixote Soldiers does. It talks about the undoing of segregation.
I want to talk for a minute about tension that exists today. Maybe the issue is not so much class, and you might disagree with me on this, but the tension between Latinos who have been in this country and have relatives in this country for generations as opposed to new immigrants, and that sense, almost reflecting back what we were talking about with Henry Bean Gonzalez, that there is a sense that there's some community and yet people are afraid of sort of giving up what they have gained. Can you talk about that?
Oh, yes, very good. And actually, There's a phrase for that. It's called walls and mirrors. There's a book to that by that title, Walls and Mirrors. Walls, and now I'm talking about the Mexican-American community, the walls that they established between themselves and the recent immigrants. And as a matter of fact, until the 1950s, you had LULAC that was supporting deportations. Then they were supporting a deportation campaign. This is LULAC. They don't change their position until the mid-50s. So this idea that there's tension between the Mexican-American who's been here a while, who third, fourth generation, and the recent immigrant, yes, that does occur. The mirror part, of course, should be obvious. You know, these immigrants, they look like my parents. They look like my grandparents. They look like us. And as a matter of fact, the non-Hispanics can't tell us apart. The non-Hispanic cannot tell us apart. And that...
I'm not sure that's universally true.
Well, in California, anyway, what's happened as a result of the current anti-immigrant sentiment is that it very easily translates, unfortunately, into an anti-Latino sentiment. And you do still have individuals, non-Hispanics, who can't tell the difference, okay, who will assume that the Mexican-American, who may have been here generations, right, and especially in San Antonio and in places like New Mexico or El Paso, we find individuals who have been in Texas and the United States for generations, but nonetheless are treated as recent immigrants. And so you can understand then that kind of anti-Latino sentiment has created a unity among Mexican-Americans and Mexican immigrants. And it's very interesting to see this dynamic in California.
Do you think that the apex of Latino political power is still ahead of us, given that in every election we talk about this is the year, and although there's been a growing amount of power and voter participation, it seems like there are still people who are not fully participating?
No, that's correct. Yes. Well, to a short answer, I believe that, yes, the apex is still to come. We're not there yet. And you can see it in the way at the national level, for example. All regardless of whether the Republicans or Democrats are in power, they're all very conscious of their high-level appointments. So, you know, under George Bush, you know, we had several. Under George Bush Sr. and George Bush Jr., we had several appointments of Mexican-Americans to cabinet positions. And so we've seen that tendency is going to continue. Now,
we have about 10 seconds.
Numbers are not enough. We have to go out and vote in order to achieve that apex, and we're not quite there yet.
David Montejano is professor of ethnic studies at Berkeley. His new book is called Quixote Soldiers, A Local History of the Chicano Movement, 1966 to 1981. David, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It went by so fast.
Good. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.